We're going to make this an intimate talking session. And we're going to try to engage the audience. And the truth of the matter is, the value of this session is going to be you all and your input and your questions. If the session is successful, it means that you were engaged. If it isn't successful, it's because you were not. Because we're here for an hour and a half to really address your questions. You have an opportunity to talk to some people in the private sector who actually deliver the development that you all want and you ask for. And I'm sure you're sitting in your offices or you're out viewing developments and you're saying, how come they did that? How come they won't do this? What's going on? And we're going to try to give you that perspective of what's going on. Before I get started, I'm going to introduce everybody. There's a quick rebuttal. I thought what was said this morning was quite valuable. Just as good information is valuable, good information is also dangerous if you don't fully understand it. One thing that they mentioned this morning was the concept of doing an impact study from an economic perspective. I think that's great. Every development ought to do that. Unfortunately, most studies are done in what's called a slice of time. So you only look at where it is today. You don't account for the fact that property values change, the taxes change, the income changes, and you really need to look at it in a longitudinal way. So while I really encourage impact studies that include the economic features, urge you to consider that it also should look over time and not just be a slice of time. The other thing that was implied, if you will, which is accurate, is that much development doesn't pay for itself if, in fact, the government has to pay for infrastructure. But in Montgomery County, as you know, we have a number of fees, and as was kind of alluded to, and many of you may know of development that you see that's perhaps one of the most successful suburban-style developments, and perhaps one of the last that we'll see in a while in Clarksburg. And Bob Spalding, who I'll introduce in a minute, is involved with that. But just so you get a perspective of it, you know they pay an impact tax, right? Bob, do you have any idea how much impact Bob Spalding? What Clarksburg will generate in impact taxes?
I don't know the total number right now, but the impact tax on a single-family detached home in Clarksburg is over $46,000 right now. And for a townhouse, it's $36,000, and for a multifamily, it's $25,000. And since 2003, when we started building out there, those have gone up almost 600%. So they've gone up $40,000 almost for a single family house. And the prices of the houses that we're selling have not gone up. And for a while, they went down. So we've been basically absorbing all of that.
What's the total you think that over the life of Clarksburg, based on today's dollars, that you'll end up spending, collecting, paying?
I don't know what the total is for the entire community. I mean, we've got individual communities that we're building up in Clarksburg and homes that we're building in Clarksburg Town Center, but it's those, you just multiply out by those numbers and that's what it's going to be.
The number I was told was $120 million.
But in addition to that, we're also building all the water lines, all the sewer lines, all the roads that we have to need for it, in some cases more than what we need for it, and we're building all the parks, and it's a very different situation than the Florida examples that were given.
In Florida, they have a rule, I forget the name of it, it's called the...
Concurrency.
What's it called?
Concurrency.
Concurrency, thank you, concurrency, which means that in order for you to get a building permit, in order for you to get a subdivision permit, the road has to be in place. Has to be in place. So I'm not sure what his data is, but that's been something. That's one of the reasons why there are maybe thousands of approved lots, but you can't build. I mean, the reason why developers approve thousands of approved lots is because they'll wait for somebody else to build the road, and then they'll follow up and say, okay, well, developer A built the road, so now I don't have to pay anything. So they pre-approve all the lots. It's sitting there, but there's no intention of building them until somebody else builds the infrastructure because of that rule unique to Florida that requires it to be in place. All right, so here's the format. I'm supposed to introduce everybody. So I'm going to do that. Before I do, I have a question for the audience. How many people here are in the private sector? Would you raise your hands? Okay. I want everybody else to recognize that they're the ones paying your salary. Right? Atif, we talked about that earlier. Who pays for all the permit fees?
I'm not going to answer.
Okay. You didn't have to answer. So thank you guys for being here. I really appreciate it. The format is the following. I'm going to introduce everybody. I'm going to give each of them 5 minutes to talk about their sector. Then I'm going to allow them to ask each other questions and comments. And then I'm asking you all to give me questions. Most of the session is you all asking me questions. And if you can't come up with questions, I'll make them up a lot as I go. But I'm sure that we can do that. But to get us started, I thought I'd do something different. And that is that I'm going to play a little game. And this is a real game in the sense that this really happens. So there's a piece of property. It's in Wheaton, Silver Spring, Bethesda. And the owner passes away. And after study, they recognize that there's a long-lost nephew that's the surviving benefactor. And they didn't even know they had this owner. And that person is Roberto Duke. Is he here? Roberto, randomly chosen, just as happens in real life. He didn't know. Did you know you had an uncle that had a property in Bethesda?
No,
oh my God. Well, you just inherited 5 acres in Bethesda. There's a little office building there, and the rest of it's open space. And you've got to do something with it. And the executor just called you up, and he went, oh my God, what do you want to know?
What I want to know?
Yeah.
Well, first, the exact location.
Of course. You got that.
Got that.
You got the map.
Okay. And I want to know what, you know, is it occupied? And,
yeah.
And what sort of the taxes on it?
Okay. Okay. You have it. What are you going to do with it?
I'm going to talk to one of my friends to see what can be done for the highest and best use.
You want to know the highest and best use? Why?
Because I want to make a profit.
Oh, you want value out of it. Oh, my God. Well, guess what for you? You're so lucky. Not only did the executor tell you you got this property, but I put together this panel. Because if you got this problem, you said you want to know what the highest and best use, the first thing you do is ask your friends, and they say, well, you better talk to Ellie here, because she knows the market, and she's going to have you talk to Bob Harris, because Bob Harris is one of the best zoning attorneys in Montgomery County, just recently in the Washington Post, is one of the superstars. And then you're going to want to talk to Dusty Rude at Rogers Consulting, because he's the guy that designs things, he can tell you what it's going to cost, what you can achieve, and then you're going to talk to Bob Spaulding because you're going to want to partner the development for you. And Bob's been in the business forever. He used to work in the city of Rockville, knows the public side, knows the private side. You're going to say, really, what can I do here? And then finally, you're going to talk to Randy Melvin, who knows construction up and down the Kazoo, because that's what he does for a living. You're going to say, well, if I were to build something, how much would it cost? How much money would I make out of all this stuff? So aren't you lucky? So we're going to start with Ellie Giles, who's with the Montgomery Business Development Corporation, who's going to tell you a little bit about the broad market and what you now, as the owner of this property, trying to get the highest and best use, what you're looking at and what to do about it.
Good morning, everyone. Again, my name is Ellie Giles. I'm the Director of Operations at Montgomery Business Development Corporation. MBDC is a public-private economic development organization that represents the business community and the interest in the business community to sustain our great quality of life here, as well as judiciously and prudently enhance businesses. So one of our roles here is to look at how we can best market Montgomery County. And the way we do it is by using data. The data is our best way to inform, and I was really impressed today that we talked a lot in the early presentation about looking at the data and how the data is going to inform development. And that's exactly what we're doing. In MBDC, our big focus areas are marketing the individual community. We're looking at marketing material for, right now, we've already put out Silver Spring, Wheaton, Bethesda, Gaithersburg, Rockville, Germantown. We're done some things on the incentive program, and we're continuing to look at not only communities in the area, but also in, industry sectors, to be able to market them and see where they're best working, where they're clustered together, what is the community wanting, what is the culture within the community, what are the demographics within that community, what are the commuter patterns, and being able to inform different industries and businesses how to grow their businesses in that area or to attract businesses to an area that's going to be most beneficial to them. The other area we look at is a lot of data. We're a partner with University of Maryland. We look at quarterly data, which is on our website. We update every quarter of what are the latest information from population, from taxes, from occupation focuses, and we continue to look at that data each day to inform not only economic growth, but also policy development. So we were very instrumental in providing data as they started to analyze the minimum wage legislation and how it was going to impact the business community. So we also are looking at a lot of GIS data. Nothing tells a community story better than mapping and GIS data. So we have a partnership with the McKinsey Group, and they have a neat program called Data Story. We're putting together data maps to help inform the communities and look at projections for growth. And our last area, obviously, is business intention and business attraction, working to build and enhance the culture of Montgomery County while also trying to bring in more businesses, whether it's small or headquarter businesses. Every business is valuable. So we want to look at what we can best do there. We want to make sure that Montgomery County is competitive with the area. And so those are the things we want to look at as enhancing. What is our biggest asset in Montgomery County? What do businesses want? They want workforce. We have the workforce here. We're working very hard with all of our universities here to enhance the workforce, to not only look at the current job openings and availability, which is a changing trend, but also what will be the jobs of the future, so we're ahead of the game. So we'll work with the universities and Montgomery County Public Schools to help enhance the workforce development within career pathways in Montgomery County, which is a huge asset. And whenever we talk to companies, that's the first thing they want to know is how they can leverage that workforce. We're also looking real at the taxes and how the taxes impact business. So as we look now for cybersecurity as being a big focus for the new industry, we are really analyzing how we can best leverage the energy tax so that businesses can make money, create incentives, so that if we're going to have big data centers here, which is what we're going to need for cybersecurity, that it's going to be affordable and competitive with other areas. So our whole big area here is to just foster an ecosystem and an environment that is very business friendly and conducive to business, but also enhancing the assets we already have in Montgomery County. Thank you.
If you looked at this conference, you'll see two words a lot. You'll see balance and sustainability. And the title of this session was Balancing Environment and Economic Development. So you started off with economic development. The environment is something we all care about. And now we start talking about how the rules conflict, if you will, or perhaps support, in some cases, the dual goals of achieving what Ellie's trying to achieve, which is Montgomery County should be an attractive place to grow, and now delivering on that. So now we're going to start into that, where Bob Harris will say to Roberto. Roberto, you have any questions? Not yet. Okay. Roberto's still listening. Okay. I might call on a couple of other people here for questions. So if you have questions, start thinking about them, because I will call on you. So Bob, Roberto's now come to you, and he said, wow, there's a big market out there, cybersecurity, all kinds of neat things. The environment, we've got this department that really wants to encourage economic development. It seems like they want to help me. Tell me what I can do here. What am I going to do?
Well, first of all, good morning to all of you. Thank you for coming. Excuse me. I'm going to be the first one to rain on Roberto's parade, sadly. Sometimes I have to do that to clients when they come in the door. By way of background, I grew up in Silver Spring too many decades ago. I've worked and lived here all my life. I know the county very well, I believe, and I've been practicing zoning law for about 35 years, so I feel as if I know that arena as well. I see a number of people in the audience here with whom I work at Park and Planning, that is, a former planning board member, and I think I saw even the chair of the planning board step in here. So I'm honored there. Please don't take anything I say personally. I love working with you folks, and I know how well-intentioned all of you are. But there are some problems here in Montgomery County, and Roberta's about to face them. Excuse me. We've done a number of things in terms of rewriting the zoning ordinance now. We're doing minor master plans that we didn't used to do. We've streamlined the development approval process to some degree. There is a lot more work that needs to be done in each of those arenas, though. But the biggest thing I want to alert Roberto to today is the master plan challenges we have. In my mind and Roberto's reality here, our master plan process has three inherent problems with it from my perspective. One is that our master plans are far too specific in their content. Two is that they are applied too rigidly. And three, that the process for updating them is way too complicated and too lengthy, and it's going to prevent Roberto from achieving the pot of gold he thought he had inherited here. And I'll give a good example of this, and with due respect to one member in the audience who knows as much about this issue as I want to turn to the GEICO property in Friendship Heights. I happen to represent GEICO, and they've been there since 1955, same building. In 1974, the county did a master plan, technically called a sector plan, for the Friendship Heights area that identified what development was going to happen. Well, the county approached GEICO at that time and said, what do you want to do? They said, look, we're hanging on by our fingernails as an insurance company. We don't have any plans to do anything. They said, thank you very much. And the county planned other properties around them for development and redevelopment, but the GEICO property, it said no new development there. That was in 1974. By the mid-80s, GEICO was growing pretty well, and we approached the county jointly and said, look, that was 1974, this is 1987 then. We want to expand our office. We need more employees. County said, sorry, can't you read the 74 plan? It says no new development. We said, okay, well, you know, what can we do about that? Well, I said, the plan is the plan. Can we change it? Sure, as soon as we get around to it. Well, ultimately, the county got around to amending the Friendship Heights sector plan in 1998, by which time GEICO said, business is business, see you later, and built a new regional facility down in Stafford County, Virginia, more than 500,000 square feet. So today, they're still living in the same building from the 50s. We did get approval in 1998 sector plan to expand and actually to redevelop the site into a mixed-use site with housing and office that would have been great. Now, it's less than an eighth of a mile to the metro station. It's a stone's throw. And that would be good, but by then the train had left the station and GEICO had already grown. There are other examples of this. I don't want to hog the time here today, but that is the kind of thing Roberto is going to face with this property. And so what we have to do in this county is to make sure that our master plans are not so specific that you can't achieve the overall vision without meeting the particulars. And frankly, we've shot ourselves in the foot in that respect with our new zoning ordinance, because the CR zone and a number of the other zones now require, mandate, that you be substantially consistent with the master plan. So whereas it was just an unwritten rule before, now it's a written rule. It's part of the law. So it has taken that noose and it has tightened it around Roberto's neck, I'm afraid. So that's my, you know, biggest concern about development in the county, and something we have to do something about.
Any questions, Roberto? How you doing? Feeling better? Well, Roberto, unfortunately, I have some frightening news for you. When you inherit property, you have to pay a huge tax. And so the property's been valued at about $20 million, and the taxes could be a lot of money. It could be $3, $4, $5 million. In fact, it could be $50 million, half the property. So you got to do something about it. Fortunately, I got somebody here to help you. Dusty's going to tell you what you have to do to get an approval, and he even has some ideas of what things are going to cost, and he'll help you, right, Dusty? You help?
I'll do my best.
Okay.
Thanks. Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for attending this session this morning and for attending this conference.
Thank you. Well.
My name is Dusty Rude. I'm a partner at a firm called Rogers Consulting. We're a almost 60-year-old firm that is located in Montgomery County, has always been located in Montgomery County. And we work very closely with landowners, with investors, with developers, with builders, primarily on the technical and administrative side to help them get through the approval process in Montgomery County, help them identify what their properties are worth, what their infrastructure costs and obligations are going to be, as well as what they can build on their property. And then we design it for them. And then we submit plans to parking planning and the various county agencies, and we get those approved. So the first thing, Roberto, that I'm going to do is I'm going to put a stack of papers that I'm going to need you to sign before we can get started. But I'm only going to charge you about $25,000 at first. So what we're going to need to do is we're going to need to start off with a feasibility study, and we're going to need to learn a lot more about your property. Heck, you didn't even know you had this property, so you probably don't know anything about it. So for about $25,000 or so, we're going to go out there and we're going to start with doing a survey of the property. We need to figure out where the boundary is. We need to figure out what buildings are on it, and parking, and what the topography is like. We need to look at the roadways. We need to figure out what the master plan calls for in terms of ultimate right-of-way dedication, to figure out how much of your ground you're going to have to give away when you go through the future process of improving it. I understand that the building is partially vacant, and it really is sort of out of its useful life. So really it's becoming a liability, and it's going to have to be redeveloped, repurposed. So we're going to start to map out the property. As part of this process, we're going to need to look closely at whether or not there's any floodplain or stream valley or wetlands, if there's any significant or specimen trees, if there's any forest on the property. These are all things that later on down the road you'll be glad you figured out early. We're going to take a close look at the master plan. As Bob said, master plans have very specific ideas for what they want to see on a property. We're going to talk about what the master plan for your property calls for. And that master plan could very well be 20 years old. So we have to see what not only what it's called for, but what how that complements or contradicts where the market is today. Once we start to sort of map out all the constraints on the property, we'll have sort of a net developable piece of ground that we can look at in terms of where the opportunity is. We're going to look at the zoning ordinance and find out what densities are on the property. We're going to look at height restrictions, and we're going to multiply basically our net developable land area by our density to determine what type of usable space we can come up with. So that's about $25,000. That's going to sort of get you an idea of what you have. I'm then going to sort of put together a development approval process schedule for you to talk to you about what it takes to take the property from what it is today to what we think it can be in the future, given what the market calls for and everything else. And we think we have an opportunity here. You're only in about $25,000 at this point. But then we're going to spend this development approval process schedule that I'm going to give you. It's going to show us filing a project plan on your property. It's going to show us going through various pre-submission meetings, meeting with members of the community, submitting your plans to parking planning electronically. Right now there's some issues that we have to work through there, but we'll get there. So we're going to do that. And we're gonna basically start down that process probably about 9 to 12 months from now. You know, I'm gonna ask you to save some time on your calendar. Don't plan any vacations, because we're gonna hopefully get to a planning board hearing where this is gonna be discussed. At that point, you're gonna get the planning board. By the time you submit your project plan, I have to tell you, we will have done that. You'll have spent a lot more money at that point. $25,000 for your feasibility study will have, that'll be money that's spent. You know, at this point, you're going to be a couple hundred thousand dollars in your own money out of your pocket. Bank's not going to give you any money for this, by the way. Maybe he'll do it for you, But he wants some of your upside. So, you got a couple $100,000 in, you're getting to planning board. But they actually love your project. This is great. We've got an opportunity here. And you're not quite ready to sell to him yet because you want to realize a little bit more value. So we've got to do some engineering, and we're looking at some real money there. You know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, we're probably looking at $500,000-$700,000. So, you know, by this point, you're getting close to being $1 million out of pocket at this point. And we get into engineering, and I just discovered because we didn't do test pitting early that there's some major infrastructure problems that's going to be a major problem for us down the road. So. We're gonna have to engineer some other solutions to deal with that, and hopefully the agencies will work with us on that. So that's what I do. Two areas that I want to talk about where the development approval process and the regulatory environment create some conflicts, which they don't necessarily need to do, and really sort of two takeaway recommendations that I have. One area where a property like yours, Roberto, being a redevelopment opportunity located in a desirable urban setting, Montgomery County and the state of Maryland have a very challenging to implement stormwater management rules. And these rules require you to locate these small little sponge-like areas all throughout your property, even on your roof. And it becomes pretty challenging, pretty costly. There's actually a way in which Montgomery County can give itself more flexibility, much as the city of Baltimore does, by creating what's called a watershed management plan. And what that is actually a legal term. It's in Maryland state law that if a community develops a watershed management plan where they comprehensively map out a stormwater management strategy for a watershed specific area, there's a lot greater flexibility that can be afforded on a site-by-site basis. The city of Baltimore does this. Each individual property owner has a little bit of stormwater management they do on their property, but then they really are contributing towards more regional bang-for-the-buck solutions that are going to go a long way. So that's one area where I think Montgomery County can help make itself more competitive. The other area is, you know, your property doesn't have any trees on it, it doesn't have any forest on it, doesn't even have any stream valley on it, but we have to go through doing this forest conservation plan. And you know, we can't even demolish your building, which you think you might be able to start doing to help entice development, until we go through the entire forest conservation plan approval process and get every sign off possible. So I think in projects like yours, we need to look at what we're really trying to achieve with forest conservation. I think what we're really trying to do on your property is address urban forest canopy. And I think we need to call it that. I think we need to modify how we administer our forest conservation law in the urban redeveloping context. So that's the wishes of you, Roberto.
So it looks like it's going to cost you a little bit of money. I guess we need to think so. Okay. Now, fortunately, in the audience, if someone's going to talk about this later, I'm going to just take a minute to introduce, because you're so lucky to have him, and I urge you to go to his session. Jonathan Jen from Perconte is doing a session on, what is it, financing and money. And so those of you who are interested in that side of it should absolutely attend that. I think I'm going to attend it and always learn something there. But you kind of need some money, about maybe $1 million at risk. You may not get an approval at the end of that, by the way. Wow. Well, fortunately, I know this guy. Think about Miller and Smith. I tell you, they're one of the best in the area. You got a great reputation. They got money, I think. That's a check. Doing all right. One of the biggest builders in the region. They love working on these challenges. They know how to do it. They got a really good guy, Bob Spalding. I got him on the phone. So, Bob, you interested in helping this guy? What are you going to do? What do you do?
Sure. Good morning, everybody. And I mean, overall, the county's done a great job with smart growth and environmental protection. Where it gets really hard to implement those council adopted visions is when you go through the public regulatory process and the not so public regulatory process after you get your approvals. I've invested my entire career working in planning in Montgomery County and implementing plans in Montgomery County. And my wife and I have made it our home. We could have lived anywhere we wanted to, but we chose Montgomery County, just like many of you guys have done as well. And you know, one of the things that common thread, hopefully, for all of us in this room is that any plans that we've been involved in, whether it's a minor review of it or you're actually out there building it and selling it to the person who's living in it, is you can take a lot of pride in the fact that people love the places that you worked on. You've got, you know, people are investing their life savings, they're raising their families there, and it's great. It's very rewarding, and it takes a long time and a lot of money to get there. Want to do one little more audience participation thing. Can you raise your hand if you have a 401k or you have a retirement plan at work? Okay, great. Unless you've been surgical about it, you're real estate investors. You just about anything that you can invest in any plan has some real estate element in it. So you're all in this together with us. And you know, some of what we're doing, you know, we're a privately held company, but there are a lot of publicly held companies like Randy's and others that are producing everything that's necessary to make your retirement plans grow. And we actually work with some of the retirement funds out of California to manage their properties in this area. So it is something that we've all got a stake in addition to just having a great community. And to get into the developer side of it a little bit, you know, Father Guido Sarducci back from Saturday Night Live fame had the 5-minute university, and for economics he talked about the only thing you need to remember is supply and demand. And in the real estate development business, there's a graduate course in his university called Risk Reward. And whether you think about it or not actively, you all participate in this every day. When you sign up for which pension plan or which fund you're going to invest in your 401k, you're looking at its past rate of return, what it's, you know, whether it's a small cap or a large cap, or you know, how risky is it, and how much money can I make off of it. Well, we do the same thing when we look at a piece of property. And there's several different types of risk that we have to go through. We've got pursuit risk, entitlement risk, construction risk, and market risk. The pursuit risk is the money that we spend in that very early stage that Dusty was talking about with Roberto, where it can be a couple hundred thousand dollars or even over $1 million depending on the property, because we didn't inherit it. We're having to buy it, and we have to come in and give Roberto a deposit, and sometimes that deposit's at risk. So we do a quick feasibility study in the first 45 days that we're between our letter of intent and our contract, and we have to figure out whether we're going to give him $500,000 that he gets to keep if we walk away from the deal. And then we go through and spend additional money with Dusty going through the process. So we can be $1 million into the project before we've got any approvals or any certainty. And sometimes the best investment in that project is to walk away from that $1 million. There are several projects we wish we had done that with in 2005. We would have been a lot healthier as a company if we had done that. So that pursuit risk is dangerous. Then once you've made the commitment to it and you have the property under contract or you own it outright, because sometimes sellers want you to buy it right now, so you're now carrying the full weight of that burden on you. So if you buy a $10 million property, you're paying the interest on that every day. You can be paying thousands of dollars a day in interest. So time's very important when you're at this stage. And unfortunately, this stage can last a long time. So the entitlement risk is, you know, all the risks that it takes to get through the entitlement process, to get approvals. How long does it take us to even get our application in the door, to get a checklist approved, to get the internal reviews, to get to the DRC meeting, to get to the second DRC, the third DRC, and then the follow-up meetings to resolve the conflicts. Every day costs us money on that. Not to mention the $1,000 an hour that we're having to pay for our consultants to attend the meetings with us. So the meter sprints pretty fast in this cab ride you're on. Then you get into the fees changing underneath of you. Like I mentioned earlier, we have properties in Clarksburg that we put under contract. All pro formas and budgets are all based on the 2003 prices with some cost increases, but we never imagined that the impact tax for a single-family detached house would go up 592% in 10 years. It's $46,200 for a single-family detached house now. It's a lot of money for a house. It's sometimes 10% of the price of the house right there just on impact taxes. Plus, we're building all the facilities, all the public roads that get turned over, inside the community, they don't count towards that impact tax credit. You only get that for off-site improvements that meet very critical criteria. And also, each new neighborhood that we build is its own company. Even though it's a Miller and Smith neighborhood, it's a different investment pool for each neighborhood. So each one has to stand on its own. And one of the things that we've run into is an entitlement risk is somebody will say, well, gee, Miller and Smith's a big company. You can afford that. Well, we can't afford $1 million amenity on a 100-house neighborhood. It just doesn't pencil out. The project doesn't work when you do that. But, you know, you have to rob Peter to pay Paul sometimes in order to stay alive as a business? Yes. But when people use that as a justification, it's just wrong. And it's not a proportionate impact of that neighborhood that should be accommodated by that neighborhood. And then you get, and time's also, as I mentioned, time's a major entitlement risk. Frederick County and Howard County have, they use the S word in their plan review process, and I know Montgomery County hates it, but it's called schedule. You file an application, when you get up, they say if you file by January 2nd, you will have your DRC meet, your first DRC meeting on this date. You then have 2 weeks to respond to it and return your comments. You then will have your second DRC meeting 4 weeks later. You then have another 2 weeks to respond to the comments, and then you send it in for final review, and you're at the Planning Commission in May or June. I've taken longer than that, almost twice as long as that, to go from the last DRC meeting to the Planning Board approval in Montgomery County. It's just, the reviews are just as critical, just as thorough, but they're done on a schedule. And the quality of the development that you get out of it is just as good, and in some cases better, because we didn't have to waste $100,000 on carrying that property for an extra year. We can do a better job when we know what the final costs are going to be. And then when we get into construction risk, you know, run into bad soils or any of the problems that, you know, utilities that we weren't aware of that weren't mapped on the plans, all those run into your costs. And then finally, the market risk. It takes so long to get through the approval process, you can start planning in the depths of a recession, get it approved, get it built, and finally sell it, and you have no idea if you're going to be back in another recession and miss the boom, or if you're selling in the boom. And it just, that can kill you on being able to get your loans and everything. And that's just the tip of the risk iceberg. On the financial reward side, you know, because you're doing this for a reward. You're not doing it just because, oh, it'd be nice to build a building. You know, none of us have that much money to just do it that way. We all have a risk reward thing. We all get paid for our jobs. So that's the reward we get. And in addition to the less tangible awards you get from doing what you love. But how long can you tolerate an investment that loses money for the first 6 to 7 years of an 8 to 9 year investment? That's what you're looking at if you're developing a property in Montgomery County, because of the length of time you're involved in.
Roberto has a question for you there, Bob. Excuse me. Roberto says, I really want to do an environmental assessment job here. And I know you guys wipe out the trees and you grade. How do I do that? How can I want to be environmentally sensitive. Do I not make money if I'm going to be in one? What's the story there?
Well, like anything, there's going to be trade-offs. The more you want to save of the existing property in its current state, the less opportunities you have to develop on it, and that could affect the return that you're going to get. Fortunately, you inherited the property, so you have a very low basis in it in terms of how much money. You've only spent $1 million to get this far, so you have a little more flexibility on being able to either add expensive elements such as green roofs, or to protect certain areas more than it would be required under the county law. And it also depends on whether you're going to continue to own the building. You know, if you build an apartment building and you're going to be the landlord and you add in all of the bells and whistles you can think of, from solar, wind, green roof, extra insulation, every green thing you can imagine, you do a green platinum building, or LEED platinum building, and it basically is earning, you have almost no utility costs. Over time, that investment will pay back to you. If you're building it and you want to sell it right away,
people are not going to pay that premium that it costs you to do that extra work. You know, like when we're building a single family house, if we want to go above and beyond the code and add something that costs us $10,000 to add to our house, we may only get $1,000 from a homeowner in doing that. So we've really got to want to do it in order to do that, because they're looking at what the next builder next door is doing and said, I can get that same square footage for a cheaper price. Why would I pay this extra? Well, your utility bill is going to be cheaper, but I can get that for a cheaper price. And it never connects. You can do the life cycle cost, you can give them all the spreadsheets you want, but it's tough to sell it on it when you're doing it as a market item.
So that's a great transition to the next speaker, Randy. Randy is the construction expert. He's an engineer, designer. He knows construction. He works at Winchester, and his job is to look at how they build things and how they can build them better, cheaper, faster, stronger, and meet all the codes. And Winchester is one of the few building companies that goes to the effort to actually hire an expert with that kind of background. And I just have to spend 30 seconds to say thank God for Randy and his work in the industry. I know that the Batiks Group, PPS, maybe gets tired of it, but Randy's there and he meets with them and he's willing to educate, he's willing to spend time to tell and teach what it takes and what it costs and what has to be done in order to build the kind of structures that both the county wants and the market wants. And as an industry and as the MNCBIA, we're just so lucky to have Randy. I wanted to just put in a plug for him. And also want you all to know that behind the scenes, a lot of things have happened because of Randy that we think benefit the county. Randy, it's your time.
Thank you, Bob.
But don't mention climate change, and that's an insult.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And thank you, everybody, for coming today. In addition to my background in construction, I spend a lot of time in codes and standards work. I'm a consensus committee on the National Green Building Standard, ICC 700, and I'm one of a handful of builders that will represent the NAHB in the 2018 International Energy Conservation Code.
That's the National Association of Home Builders.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bob. Thank you. Okay, so we've kind of gone through what has to happen. Now we're getting close where we can actually kind of design the house and build it. There's another set of regulations called codes, building codes, energy codes, mechanical code, plumbing code, fuel gas code. So there's additional regulations that we now need to comply with as we're doing our design. And this is kind of to illustrate some points of what's involved in codes and getting permits. If you look at the house on your left, by show of hands, how many people think that's a two-story house? Okay. How many think it's a three-story house? How many think it's a four-story house? How many think this is a trick question and you're not playing? You would be right. And how many of you are sleepy and didn't respond? Okay. All right. Well, that's a four-story house. And if you look at the picture on the right, it's the same house. One's front and one's the back. If it's a three-story house, it gets permitted under what's called the IRC, the International Residential Code. If it's a four-story house, it goes into the same group as a high-rise commercial building called IBC, International Building Code. It's pretty darn close to a three-story townhouse, but it has this little outdoor living space on the back you can see here. That seems to be popular, and the gentleman earlier today kind of talked about there's some benefit in going up when land is expensive. It helps the tax base. You get more tax base on less land and things like that. To get a permit for a three-story townhouse or a single-family home, you can do what's called refer back or master file. And what that means is if you take that set of plans, and by the way, this is also not simple,
typical set of architectural plans for townhouse might be 150 to 250 pages now, with thousands upon thousands of details that are required by code. To me, it's more complex than it needs to be, but that's where it is. Fortunately, there's this process called referback, which means we bring that plan into the county for the three-story townhouse. They go through the couple hundred pages, details, give us some feedback, knowing you need to add this, change this, whatever, and then finally it goes through mechanical reviewers and the fire department for the fire reviewers for sprinklers. Finally, the plan comes back, approved, we're ready to build. Now we say, hey, look, we've got this job South County, we've got a job North County. We want to build it North County as well as down South County. Great, no problem, it's already approved. You can refer back to the original review. Four stories, you can't do that. And as you can see, there isn't a heck of a lot of difference between a three-story and four-story townhouse.
Thank you, Bob. And we should be able, we should be able to do that. And why am I stressing this? Kinda, I believe the county has a vision. We want sustainable houses. We want to work towards sustainability, more sustainability. And we also want to work towards more affordability. We want people to be able to afford a house, and we want them to be, practically sustainable. There's opportunities to improve in efficiencies. And this is one example. If we want to get where we want to get, we need to be efficient in how we do things. So I would like to see a master file for a four-story as well as a three-story. It's a win-win. The guy at the county doesn't, and it might be a different guy at a different guy's desk, and the plan reviewer did the last one, may have left the county. So why reinvent the wheel? Why torture ourselves? Why delay? Might prevent a homeowner from getting in on a deadline. So let's get more efficient. So if we want to be sustainable, and affordable, we need to be more efficient. Second item I'd like to talk about is the codes. How many people think that renewable energy should be given credit under the energy code? Renewable energy might be solar power or wind power. How many would like to see? Okay. The energy code gives no credit for solar power. No credit for renewable energy. In addition, how many people think if you put in a 95% efficient furnace, you should get credit instead of putting in an 80% efficient furnace? Again, no credit under the code. How many think if you make a house too tight, possibly you could have some unintended consequences? Too tight condensation, air quality, you rely on mechanical ventilation can fail, did it get sized right, does the damper get stuck or whatever. Okay, the point I'm trying to make here is, the way our energy code currently is, Montgomery County kind of takes what's given to us from the national level, and what the national level gives us is not perfect. And this slide kind of demonstrates. First of all, the code process is a pretty good process and it works pretty well, but it's not a perfect process and there's problems. And where there's problems, the county needs to be flexible and give consumers choice, fix the problems. The more choices, we can build a better house, more energy efficient, at the least cost, which kind of gives us the goal of both sustainability and affordability. If you look at the picture here, this is special interest in the room, and actually that's kind of a government and private sector special interest in conjunction, and this is kind of the normal audience. So obviously these people got over what they want on the left. 40 to 50 states threw it out. So basically the conclusion is if we want to be sustainable and affordable, we also need efficient, we need to look at our processes, do some things that make common sense. And we also need to be willing to amend our codes to do what makes sense to achieve that balance of affordability and sustainability. And one final point I'd like to make, if we go back to this townhouse,
Montgomery County does not exist in a vacuum. We have many competing jurisdictions. We have Virginia. Virginia allows air tightness trade-offs. Virginia doesn't require sprinklers. And there's other counties in Maryland. They don't treat that like a four-story townhouse, which have much higher permitting fees. They require a 13R, which is a four-head flow sprinkler system for 30 minutes instead of two-head for 10. They basically say that's a three-story townhouse, so they treat it in terms of not only in refer back, but also in permitting and fees and construction costs and a number of things. So we need to be cognizant of competition around us. Thank you very much. Oh, one last thing. I talked about on consequences of a tight house. Let's say they force us, and most people do use high efficiency windows. They come out concave a little bit from the manufacturing process, and you have a very energy efficient reflective coating on them. This is the kind of thing that can happen. So don't force us into that. Here's the bar. Here's where we need to get. Don't tell us how to get there. This is just where we need to get. Thank you very much. You're the only one that got applause, Randy. The question back here. Hold on. Right? Mary, I should do this, right? Here. I need the exercise. I didn't run this morning. I'm sorry. Go ahead. It should be on.
On the last slide, what was the distance between the window and the siding?
Okay, that slide is from Lawrence. That slide is from, if you look at the bottom, it's kind of cut off, but it's from Ernest Orlando, Lawrence Berkeley Labs. I don't know. I can tell you this. It will vary widely in how it occurs. Here's one that actually one of our service guys just sent in. I don't know if you can see this. So it happens a lot of places. It's worse in northern climates because of the angle of the sun. If you look there where the sun's high in the sky, it reflects and hits the ground. In northern climates, the sun is lower, so it more often will hit and reflect and hit another object. But you can have houses across the street. You can even have it within the same house if you have a bump out on the back of your house. You know, a center family room in the back that bumps out. The sun can come in through the side windows on the bump out and hit the back of the house. But it can get quite complex because this guy who owns the house with the good windows or energy efficient windows, he doesn't have a problem, does he? Neighbor across the street does. So it can turn, you know, it's just the kind of thing I wanted to illustrate for unintended consequences. We need to be careful. We need to give choices. And it'll minimize this and help keep costs down. Thank you.
I'm going to ask the panelists to see if they have any questions of each other or any comments. And while I'm doing that, I want you to start picking a question. And if I don't hear any questions, I'm going to start selecting people randomly. Because I know you have questions. You're not here. You're here because I'm on this line, so feel free. There's such a thing. Well, there is. You know what a bad question is? What's a bad question? The one that's not asked. Any questions or comments? Go ahead.
No.
Well, I have a question for Ellie. Ellie, we're just talking here about Montgomery County, but, you know, I see what's happening in Northern Virginia. I see what's happening in Frederick now, and Frederick, which was not doing a whole lot, all of a sudden, you know, you read a lot about it. It's great. I know some of it is due to efforts like what Smart Growth has done and identified downtown Frederick as a priority funding area and it's taken off. How do we compete? How do we compare?
We have to do a couple of things. First of all, we have to start to really leverage more of our assets. We're beginning to look at our transportation and infrastructure, but we have a long way to go with that as far as building and making development accessible for people. We need to take a look at some of the diversity we have and promote the growth as opposed to promoting a no-growth policy. And the smart growth that's happening, like in Park and Rose, again, it goes around transportation, but it needs to be replicated across the county. Some of the issues that were brought up here are the permitting challenges. They have to be addressed in a regulatory way so that we can ease that opportunity for development that both Frederick County and Northern Virginia are really addressing at this time.
Yes, ma'am. Hold on a second. We're
focusing a lot on some of the negative aspects of development in Montgomery County. What are some of the positive attributes? I mean, you're developing, so there has to be something good about it.
I'll take a stab at that. I mean, we are blessed with a wonderful place to live. As I mentioned at the outset, I've lived here all my life, and my family, my children live here as well. We've got a great quality of life here, and so we've got a lot to build upon. You know, we don't have to go very far from here to Western Maryland, Cumberland, a city that was on top of the heap 75 years ago when the railroads were running through there, and now it's a very depressed place. So we've got a lot to work with. We also have just great minds at the Planning Commission and throughout the county government that are doing creative things. You heard the first speaker today talk about our ag reserve and some of the other things that we've done great, our wedges and corridors plan. So tremendous things to build upon, but I'm afraid sometimes we get caught up in our own hype and are afraid to say that maybe we weren't that smart on something we did. Maybe a master plan, as I said earlier, that we wrote 15 years ago wasn't really right and shouldn't be changed. But this is where I've made my home and where I make my living, so I like a lot about it.
I'll talk call about it in a second, but has anybody known the quadrant theory of development? Do you know what that is? So look at that slide for a minute, and imagine if that's a x-axis and a y-axis in the middle of that slide. Development, the best development, the richest development in the East Coast, anywhere east of the Mississippi River, is always the northwest part of the quadrant. Always. Does anybody know why? There are two reasons why. Air pollution, because the prevailing winds come from the west. What's the other?
Water.
Water, because all the rivers flow north to south, which means the effluent that's untreated, and to this day, by the way, there's untreated effluent in the Potomac River. I'm sorry, we're not fixed yet. We have a combined sewer and stormwater management system in D.C. that when it rains enough, it just clogs the system, and untreated sewage goes into the Potomac River today. So the rich people said, I'm not going to live downwind and downstream. I'm going to live upwind and upstream, and you name me the city, and I will show you that the Northwest Corridor is where the wealth is. So, you see that roof line there? Well, that's the Potomac River. So, part of the Northwest is Loudoun, Fairfax, Arlington. Part of the Northwest is Montgomery. Montgomery County will always be developing. Doesn't mean it's maximized itself. It'll be developing because not only did Montgomery County have the northwest, which means the prevailing winds and the streams, it also has the highest ground. Those of you who drive through Loudoun County, et cetera, you see it's much flatter, farming is much flatter. You know, you're wealthy, you have your factory in southeast, you know, your employees are in D.C., and you live in the cleanest, freshest, nicest part. And of course, with that wealth comes better schools, better infrastructure. Now, two things are changing. One is air pollution is not as critical as it used to be. Right? Factories have to meet clean air requirements. We still get acid rain from the Midwest, but you get that in Montgomery as well as Southeast. So that's changing. The other is we are treating our effluent much better. We're building huge treatment factories. The Blue Plains has just spent tons of money. And there will be a correction to this combined stormwater system in D.C. They've got funding to do some of that. So where's the hot markets right now? You've been to Southeast, you've been to the Nationals, you love the Nationals, great team, right? You see what's happening there? That's Southeast, friends. That used to be where the poorest of the poor lived because that's where it stunk. friendly. When my parents moved here from Massachusetts, the first place we lived was Southeast. That's what we could afford. A lot of people were like that. So, but that's changing. And now Montgomery County has been sitting on its laurels all these years and say, well, they're going to develop here. I mean, I hear that all the time. Well, that's the cost of doing business in Montgomery County. Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know if that's going to last now. I mean, how many have been to 14th and U lately? Anybody who grew up here knew what 14th and U meant, right? Back in the day. Well, I haven't even, I just drove there the other day. I couldn't believe it. Busboys and Poets is there. You know, three theaters are there. Unbelievable stuff. It's just great. 14th and U. So what used to be a natural automatic bias towards wealth and growth in Montgomery County is eroding. And so I think that Ellie has a hell of a job to convince everybody that, yes, we still have, it's still a great place to live. Absolutely, schools are great. You know, my kids went to Howard County schools. I think they're better. What can I say? So, the school's great. Quality of life is fantastic. You know, it'd be nice if we can get around on transit and buses and maybe Purple Line would be great. Boy, wouldn't that be great if we didn't have to drive our cars. Anybody drive their car to Bethesda at 5 o'clock? Oh, my God. Really, you're just sitting in traffic for now. But it's just Bethesda. Most of the rest of the county, I don't know about you all, but I don't seem to have as much trouble. That area is really tough. I mean, we have to do something about that. But it's still, it's a great place to live. And I have to say, I've done a lot of work in a lot of jurisdictions. And Montgomery County has some of the best, most competent people I've ever worked with in government. Really. So, I mean, they're not intending to make this difficult for it. They don't mean to. They're trying to meet you, the county's, community's needs. They're trying to meet law. They're trying to, most of them really do understand what it's like to be a developer in this county. And they feel like they can't do a whole lot about it. They're just, you know, they're silos. And I'm going to say this once, and I'm really going to be controversial, and you'll kick me out, but, you know, only Montgomery County, Prince George's County, has a bifurcated system where you have a separate planning department and regulatory department from the county government. Everywhere else, the planning department and regulatory is one group.
And water and sewer.
And water and sewer, thank you. So you have a bi-county area, which could be good. I mean, there's some good logic behind it. But the problem is, if I have a problem, who do I go to? In most jurisdictions, you go to the county commissioner or to the county executive or the county administrator and say, I got a problem, I can't get this. I got to go to a planning board on one level, and I got to go to a county executive or a department on another level. I got to get them to agree. So guess what I need? I need a degree in psychology if I'm going to be a developer. Bob, you were
going to
say something. I'm sorry.
That's fine. In addition to some of the other aspects that were mentioned, the accessibility of Montgomery County to all sorts of things and just with being able to travel within Montgomery County, the stability of the county because of our proximity to the Washington, D.C. government and the institutions we have here. And from a business standpoint, there are high barriers to entry to develop in Montgomery County, which is a bad thing and a good thing. I mean, from a bad standpoint, a lot of the small developers and builders are gone now because they just can't bear the high upfront costs to develop in the county. But if you can figure your way through the maze and you can afford to carry the property for as long as it takes, there's a piece of cheese at the end and you can make some money. I'm paraphrasing something that David Flanagan from Elm Street says all the time, but that's essentially one of the reasons that we continue to do it. But there are times when we get stuck there. Property is not profitable, but we honor our obligations and build the community and live to fight another day.
I hear there are other questions. Yes, sir.
I'm curious about the take is by the panelists on the issue that you just raised toward the end there about the silos and the disaggregated form of governance that we face here in Montgomery County. I come from the fire department in Montgomery County as a career firefighter and the son of a businessman who owned some land in downtown Bethesda, so I feel Roberta's pain.
Are you guys related?
From the fire department, I've come to respect the chain of command. And what we have in the fire service is something called the integrated command system, which takes into account any agency or entity that would be possibly involved in a disaster or fire. and through a chain of command, and there's one boss, which is the beauty of it. So I'd like to hear some comment on our governance. I find, as a resident and an urban advocate, a bicyclist kind of guy, that no one wants to hear how to improve something. It's the NIMBYs have a voice, developers have a voice. And so I'd like to hear what the people invested in this, from your experience, feel about our form of governance and what we can do about that to give a more holistic and balanced and efficient service.
I'm going to address real quick and then turn it over, but I do want to point out some of the good things. I mean, the county executive asked for a streamlining group headed by Dan Diane Schwartz Jones, and they have made some changes. Parking planning specifically has made some dramatic changes. When smart people get together and they think about things, they usually come up with ideas that are good. We also have something called an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, that allows certain agencies to take the lead in some things. Are we there yet? Clearly not. Everybody recognizes that. I do want to at least plug, you know, I think people, smart people get this. They understand we got to make changes, but how do we make those changes when you have a bifurcated system? So I will open it up.
I'll just respond briefly, and as someone who you know, has a different position on this with respect to you know, the development approval process for Bob is a cost. For me, it's my lifeblood. To the extent that the more complicated things are, the more work I have to do. Up until a certain point, there's a diminishing return, and we're at that diminishing return. My industry, my competitors, it's a shrinking pool. Okay, so it's a survivor world out there. With respect to your question specifically, as you know, I go back to a very simple natural law of entropy. As organizations mature, they become naturally inefficient. And I think that as well-intentioned as it is, organizationally, I think that has happened in Montgomery County. That's a comment that's reflective of an organizational system. Drilling that down to sort of the topic of this with respect to environment, as I, in my simple mind, look at it, my client has a certain amount of dollars that he's able to, that he's hoping to profit off this. The more he has to spend on going through the development approval process, the less he has to do things that everybody would like for him to do. So I'll just kind of say that to kind of start the answer.
And to sort of follow up a little bit on what Dusty said in terms of the money being spent, there are times when I'll be in a meeting and somebody will say, well, we're not sure if we want to do, you know, one agency is saying we want to do X and the other is saying Y. And to us, it doesn't matter sometimes. You know, just decide and tell us. The cost to wait for 3 months to get meetings scheduled and rescheduled and get a decision is far in excess of the cost of the worst case scenario sometimes. So sometimes just making a decision. The MOUs helped a lot, but we still have the pocket veto in place in Montgomery County. If you have one person who's reviewing your job who is not doing their job and submitting their comments on time, your job is stopped. You cannot go to the planning board until that person sends their memo to the plan reviewer. Most places you get fired for that, but here it just, the applicant gets penalized, and it's very painful. And I've run a development review division in the city of Rockville. You can set schedules and you can make it. It takes work, but it can be done. Other jurisdictions are doing it. We're very smart here. We should be able to figure this out.
Rather than a broad overview of the government structure itself, that this is more of a behavior characteristic. I think that it's inherent. And this is, wouldn't be in Montgomery County. But what incentive do most folks in government have, staff level, have to take a risk? They take the safe, protected, sure thing that's going to keep them out of trouble. They're not whatever. But by doing that, we're just missing so much opportunity. And an example again, it'd be going back to codes. Model code says this, we'll go with that, we'll stay with that. Somebody's got to venture out a little bit to make, but what's the incentive for that?
Randy said that when the codes came out, I think only two states adopted them, right?
Well, the energy code initially, I think Maryland was the first, I believe, and I think at this is a 2012 code. At this point, I think there's only a handful of states that have adopted, and without heavily amending it.
When we look at governance, we have to look beyond just county government, and I think that's another big thing. It's a regional thing. It's really a global thing. We're not just competing with other counties in the state of Maryland. We're looking at other states. We're looking at it from a global perspective, and that's another big issue that we really need to be addressing from an economic growth perspective, and why it's important for all of these agencies to start to coordinate in a much more streamlined fashion. Just to plug us a little bit, County Council developed Montgomery Business Development Corporation for just that reason, to represent the voices of the community, of the businesses, go back to the people who are creating the policy and making them aware of where some of these problems are to help facilitate that streamlining.
And that's why you're invited here, and we're grateful that you're here. I wanted to tell you something I heard on NPR not too long ago, and then I'll get back to questions. But first, if you're here for credits, you've got to sign these things. I'm going to pass them around and sign these things. And then I'm going to pass around after that an evaluation form that I want you to fill out and tell me what a crappy job I did late in the morning. But I was listening on the radio, and I don't know about you all, but I'm fascinated by the Tesla. It's a cool car. I test drove one. You got to test drive. It's the coolest car I've ever driven in my life.
You got to test drive that.
Okay, well, I have one of those too. A little bigger. But Tesla announced that they are building a factory to produce batteries, which, because, you know, battery is the key thing now in Tesla. And they've now selected 20 sites that they were looking at to build this battery factory, and they're down now to 4 sites. It's interesting. What they said is that they're going to pursue all 4 as if they're going to build there. And they're going to take the first one that gets approved. It is cheaper for them to spend $1 million a site to design it than to have to go for one site and take the risk of not getting it approved in a timely way or not getting it approved at all. They're going through 4 sites at the same time, and they're not telling anybody which sites the site they're going to build. That's how they respond. All right, we have questions over here, and then I'll get back to you. Yes. Atif, you got it. Go ahead. I love talking to you. Go ahead.
Well, thanks, Phil. Roberta, congratulations on your inheritance.
I don't think you want it anymore.
Your pending bankruptcy.
The first $5 million tax-free, so we're okay. I like Bob's comment at the beginning when he said that we are all in it together. You know, it's your floor, it's your show. I'm here just to listen, but I could not help but not to say something. It's not really all
right. Thank you very much. Next question.
I got the microphone. I'm not sure. Bob and I have discussed this many, many times. It's not really always the county government's fault.
Of course.
For project delays, it goes both ways. And I have discussed it with Bob many times, the quality of submittal. You know, we can't just close our eyes and say, okay, we're going to approve it. That's why we have standards, we have codes, we have criteria that needs to be, you know, followed. So, for example, many times we make a comment and the consultant, whoever that is not even responding.
That's you, Dusty.
So if you don't respond, are you ignoring, or is just you do not agree with us? So you need to talk to us. And when we submitted, just one example about one of the record plats, we reviewed it, we sent it back. 5 years back, later, it comes back. So how is that the government? I just want to...
No, I think it's a legitimate point. We've talked about this, but I want to point back to something that Randy said, back there to the young lady in the back. The big difference is that the development community has an incentive. I mean, there's a cost to that, to them. Somebody's watching that. Somebody cares about that. It matters to somebody. If they're not doing it, there's probably a good economic reason for not doing it, But in the private, the public sector, there's really no incentive. I mean, the motivations are much different. So it's hard for you and me to explain why it is on some cases that some people do that, but I can tell you that underneath it, there's money, okay? In the public sector, we don't have that. I mean, I think Montgomery County has pride. I think employees that work here have pride, and I don't think that anybody's trying to screw us. I think that they're trying to do the best job they can, but as you asked, if you don't have a chain of command, where's the incentive? Where how do you work that though? Yes, ma'am.
I have two questions. One of them has to do with where development occurs, and I'm thinking specifically of the East County area. I work in the Tacoma-Langley area, if you will, to the edge of Prince George's and Montgomery. And but you could say the whole east side of the county. I mean, there's that study that Brookings did some years ago on the east-west divide. Colesville, New Hampshire, relatively low level of development compared to the 270 corridor, Bethesda, Germantown, bada bada, and decade in and decade out that goes on. While these older eastern veteran communities continue to kind of just stay as they've been for 50 years with very little development, reinvestment activity. That's one question. The second question is the Purple Line, which so much is being discussed about. It's been such a long time. It's going to go right, you know, through Montgomery to Prince George's. Just was at a meeting here two nights ago, 60-some people from every little civic association in the county. Everybody has an axe to grind. What sort of presented as a great leap forward in transportation, you know, has all these impacts. I don't know if it will ever get built. So much is riding on it being built. The cost increased every day. And, you know, all these risks that were just discussed. So how does a project like that ever get approved?
Gary, would you like to answer that question? Purple Line, how's it going to get built? Is it going to get built?
Of course.
I'll take a stab at the first question. West County versus East County development, there are several reasons. One is it costs exactly the same amount of money to build a building in the East County as it does in the West County, but yet the return is far greater, whether it be rent or sale, in the West County. If you were going to invest your money, would you invest it for a 1% return or 10% return? I'm pretty sure I know what you would do. And in fact, some cases, it's not even economically viable to do it in the East County. Second reason, you happen to mention Tacoma Park. EYA, like 10 years ago, proposed redevelopment in Tacoma Park, right at the metro station. And Tacoma Park fought them, and I think is still fighting them. So there was somebody who wanted to invest, and people prevented it.
One of the best builders in the area, I've got to say. I mean, I live in Alexandria. I used to live here, but now I live in Alexandria. And UIA has done these incredible jobs where they've taken low-income housing, and with the support of the city, they tore them down and then rebuilt market-rate houses and mixed in the low-income housing, so you can't even tell which is which. And it's a beautiful product, and the townhouses start with 800,000. They've sold them up to a million, too. And they're living in the same building sometimes, the same community, as low-income housing that's owned by the Alexandria Redevelopment and Housing Authority, subsidized housing. Yes, sir.
Hi, I had a question, I think maybe for Bob Harris, because you brought it up first, but maybe for all of you, you mentioned something about how the master plans are too restrictive, and I know we could probably have a whole session on just this topic, but if you could go into that a little bit more on, you know, how do you provide sort of a vision that the public can buy into, which is what the master plans, I think, are intended to provide, and assure kind of a quality of life to the adjacent neighbors and neighborhoods. You know, how do you make it less restrictive, but yet still address those issues? And also, I totally agree with the other comment about you know, by making it less restrictive, how do we get more money then into potentially into design or, you know, to some of the other amenities that could possibly be afforded if there wasn't so much bureaucracy that you have to go through in the process?
That is an excellent question and a real challenge for sure. I guess the first answer I would offer is that, in my mind, master plans should create a vision, identify a vision, but they shouldn't specify one way in which to achieve that vision. For instance, they could say, we want this area to be a walkable, mixed-use environment. They shouldn't say, this building should be 67 feet tall, it should have ground floor retail, the doors should be on this street, etc. We're just not that smart to be able to predict that kind of thing 10, 20 years out.
We're down in the last couple of minutes. One more question, and I'm going to ask Roberto to tell me what he thinks. So, Roberto, I'm going to give you a chance to think about it because you're next.
Hi, my name is Lily Chi, and I work for Montgomery County Executive Life Packet on some innovation economy and competitiveness issues. So, we are constantly looking at ways to improve all kinds of processes, including permitting. So, we're not quite done yet. So my question for the panel, since I heard some comments about how we can continue to improve permitting, is if you had a wish list of how Montgomery County can compare to other jurisdictions, what are the benchmark communities you would recommend in the capital region and why?
I would look at Frederick County, for example, the four-story townhouse we asked, you know, we talked about, that, you know, they effectively it's a three-story with a deck on the top floor. They treat it like three-story. It saves a considerable amount of money on permitting, turnaround time, and when I say considerable, I'd say by the time you get through the permit fees, 3 versus 4, 13R sprinklers versus 13D, and some other issues, you're probably pushing $5,000 to $10,000.
Well, the permit fee alone is about $6,000 difference, isn't it?
Right, right. So that would be one example.
We're very fortunate that we have the Secretary of Finance, Rich Hall, and I asked Rich if he wanted to say something, and he can't resist. Yeah, and I'm grateful for him to be here. Well,
glad to be here. I don't know how fortunate you are here, but my last name's Hall, so I have to be in the great hall. I was at the first one of these a couple of years ago, so I thank you all for putting this on and coming out. One thing I just want to mention and announce is a lot of issues you're talking about. We're certainly a 30,000-foot agency at the Maryland Department of Planning and our growth commission that we work with. And one of the things we're undertaking right now, between now and August, is calling the infill redevelopment and revitalization task that we're working on. The governor, lieutenant governor, asked us to look at this. So many of the things you're talking about here today are very relevant. So to the extent that we can capture some of these things in this session and others, we'd love to try to do that. Your ideas for infill redevelopment revitalization. Certainly, you have a lot of great examples here in Montgomery County. As you can imagine, these issues are important in Baltimore City, Hagerstown, Salisbury, and many other parts of the state. So they certainly have different flavors to them, depending where you are. But I think it's a lot of good best practices and lessons learned. So you can certainly contact me in the Maryland Department of Planning, Kristen Forsyth, and our Kristen Mitchell. Sorry, her married name, Kristen Mitchell. I've known her too long. She's our point on this in the Maryland Department of Planning, working with the agency, sister agency, and with the Growth Commission. So to the extent we can loop out with some of you after this, we'd love to do that. Again, after some of the best practices, ideas, and like to learn.
Thank you, Rich. You know, Rich, the biggest issue is stormwater management. You treat infill stormwater management the same way you treat it as if it's in Clarksburg. Same way. You can't do it. Roberto, what do you think? You got this property, what do you do?
You know, I can feel the weight on my shoulder. You know, think of, you know, I've got to go out of pocket and you know, give up all this money right now. I know in the long run, but it's just that thought right at the beginning, the out-of-pocket cost.
Do you know what's happened to Roberto? a lot. My job used to be to buy land, and one of the first things you do to buy land is you look at the obituaries. Right? And then somebody gets the property and they go, oh my God, I got this huge tax bill. First of all, I got to maintain the property. I got to pay the taxes. I got to come up with a plan. I don't know what about this. Now, the different reactions is some people say, okay, well, I'm going to be a developer. Great. And they try to be developers, and sometimes some of them succeed, some of them fail. Sometimes they're smart enough to say, I don't know this is why, and I'm going to bring in a partner. And they'll go to a Bob Spalding, and Bob said, here's the deal. I'll put up all the money, but you've got to give me the property with the following conditions, and I'll pay you as I get approvals, and I'll pay you when I get loans, but until then I can't pay you, because I got to put out $2 million before I even turn the first shovel. And then there are variations up and down the field, but I can point to properties and say, that's what happened to this property, that's what happened to that property. You know, Crown Farm's a great example of a property that was inherited, and people said, oh my God, I got a $20 million tax bill, and I got to sell this property.
King Farm.
Because I can't afford
King
it.
Farm, yeah.
So King, there, this happens. This is not just game playing, even though for today's purposes it does. So hopefully, and we're done, hopefully you've understood some principles here. Time value of money, risk reward, global competitive market. You can make a difference in your jobs and who you work with by how you deal with the applications, the work that you have to do. And we have really smart people trying to help figure this out. So it's not like no one knows this. People are trying to do things, and they're trying to involve the industry, and we appreciate that. And we have a long way to go. Any last minute comments from anybody?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.